Committee on General Government, Tuesday, May 4, 1999, 3 p.m., hearing room C. Senator Vern Duncan, Chair.
Senate Committee on General Government to order. Welcome. We have most of the Senate bills done. We're now ready to go to work on House bills. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 65-AC-6. We have Jim Crawford from the Horton Fire. Wait, who wants to be first? Representative, oh my goodness, I'm sorry, folks. I'm going to call upon Representative Randy Leonard first. Is this Jim Crawford?
I'm Bob Garrison.
Okay, Bob.
Fire Marshal's office, and then we have Jim Crawford here.
Okay, good.
Jim, no. And I just actually have some brief opening remarks. Mr. Chair,
Well, that'll be interesting. Miss you in the Senate. We'd love to be back home. We miss you in the Senate.
If you recall, last session we passed a Senate bill that became hallmark legislation, not just for Oregon, but actually for throughout the country. And that bill updated the smoke detector law in Oregon so that now in Oregon, the law is that no smoke detector can be sold that does not have a 10-year battery and a hush feature. And those two features, in and of themselves, the three of us adamantly believe, based on our collective experiences, will save many lives in Oregon. The hush feature, of course, accomplishes being able to disable the detector temporarily as opposed to removing the battery. For example, oftentimes people will unhook and it'll cause smoke and the detector will go off and what they'll do is oftentimes take the battery out. The new law requires that smoke detectors sold in Oregon, that I want to remind all of you, as my colleagues last session voted for this bill on the Senate floor, and the new law now requires these new detectors to have a button that you push if it's an alarm that some may call a nuisance alarm, and it silences the detector for 15 minutes. So that gives time for the room to clear out. And so at the end of that 15 minutes, the detector sensitivity level goes back to the previous level. It doesn't actually shut it off. It just raises the sensitivity level to the level at which you press the button when the smoke was
in. So you don't forget to put the battery back in or something.
That's the purpose of the hush feature. And again, this is current law. The second feature of the new smoke detector law that was passed last session is that the detector has to have a 10-year battery. Whereas now people are told to change your battery every year, you have a smoke detector that lasts for 10 years, and there should really be no reason. That's the other reason sometimes we find detectors disabled is when the battery gets weak, there's a little beeping noise you hear. And instead of people going out and buying new batteries, oftentimes they'll take the battery out so a little beeping noise will quit. So hopefully those two features will be instrumental in reducing fire deaths.
Sure, ask a question. It was asked to me this morning by a Senate colleague, are there a number of 10-year batteries on the market, or is it just one firm right now? Do you know offhand?
I think you're a member, and I think you're going to get into that, Bob, aren't you?
Okay,
actually, the purpose of me explaining to you the bill we passed last session is to point out to you that is current law. And all of you here, including Senator Shields when he was in the House, voted for that law, all members of this committee. What you're voting on today and what has passed the House is a technical correction bill to that law. There were some unintended consequences, for an example, that caused some harm to some Oregon-based companies, especially one Oregon-based company that manufactures smoke detectors to sell out of state. And there was an unintended consequence of possibly causing that manufacturer not to be able to even manufacture those kinds of detectors that are not allowed in Oregon for sale in other states. We wanted to fix that. Some of the hotels, for instance, the Hilton Hotel downtown Portland, actually has one of the most advanced fire and life safety systems that exist. The problem with the bill that passed last time is it could have meant that some of the equipment that they have installed would have to be replaced with these smoke detectors, which frankly aren't as technically advanced as what they have. So that's what this bill does. So any discussion that you may hear here today about whether or not 10-year batteries do or do not exist was a discussion we had last session. That has no place in this debate because it's a technocratic. If this bill died, that law is still on the books. And all we've done is harm Oregon-based companies. So I just wanted to alert you not to be caught with some red herring that really is irrelevant to this bill. So with that, I'd like to introduce Bob Garrison, who's with the State Fire Marshal's Office.
Can I ask one question before we move on? Is this applies to the apartments only or any other commercial building?
Any smoke detector sold in Oregon. I should say I'm going to let Bob
can answer that.
If I may interrupt, yes. Senator Lim.
The bill that you passed, Bob, did you mind it? It's on.
For the record, my name is Robert Garrison. I'm Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal. I'm representing State Fire Marshal Robert Panuccio today in support of House Bill 2586. Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, the bill as it was passed in 97 was intended to apply to residential applications, not commercial like you might find in this building or in a factory or a warehouse. The way it was ultimately passed, there's some question about whether it goes beyond that. And again, it's what we're attempting to do with this bill is clean that up so that it's specific to residential homes, apartments. It will apply to some hotels and motels, but I'll get into that in a minute. Okay. And as Representative Leonard has said, in 1997, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 87, and this was landmark legislation. Oregon was the first state to take some technology that existed within the smoke alarm and battery industry. They had developed, they had taken it through testing, they had made it available, and that became the standard for Oregon based on the 1997 law. And that requires specifically that if a smoke alarm is battery operated, solely battery operated, it has to be sold with a 10-year battery. And any smoke alarm, whether it's battery powered or operates on 110 volts, has to have the hush feature so that it can be temporarily silenced without permanently disabling the unit. Again, that's landmark legislation, and it got a lot of attention around the country. We found, after it was signed by the governor, some unintended consequences to that bill. Senate Bill 2586 resolves those consequences, and I'll explain to you in a minute the process that we went through to get there. It is literally a housekeeping bill. There are no new requirements imposed here. It doesn't change anything in terms of what the smoke alarm industry has for the last year and some months been required to do. It does, however, provide some relief from these unintended consequences. After we learned in the fall of 97 that there were some unintended consequences with that 1997 law, we pulled together a group of stakeholders, and obviously we included the smoke alarm manufacturers and the battery manufacturers in that, as well as wholesale distributors, retailers, end users like the Multifamily Housing Council that has a lot of rental units, people that operate college dormitories, just a wide range of some 40 or 50 stakeholders, and we invited them to come to Salem for a meeting in the fall of 97. They did that, and we proceeded to identify what the issues and concerns would be and begin working on some solutions for those issues and concerns, looking to this legislative session to be able to refine that. We spent a year developing and refining those solutions, and we communicated after that meeting with mailings, emails, letters, phone calls. There was a lot of effort went into developing what came to be Legislative Concept 325. Over that year, we went through a number of revisions to LC 325, and then in the fall of 98, we asked the stakeholders to come together again, and we had another meeting here in Salem, and they came in from all around the country. We discussed the refinements. We had a look at the LC. We found some more things that needed to be corrected, so we went back and amended the LC. This LC went through 6 or 8 variations before we finally came to what you now have as House Bill 2586. House Bill 2586 makes the following changes to the 1997 law, and I'll try to be brief with these, but some of them get a little technical, and it's kind of hard to avoid that. First of all, we needed to make a distinction between smoke alarms and smoke detectors. When the original law was passed some 25 years ago in Oregon, there really wasn't a distinction, and the law talked about smoke detectors. In 97, that law was amended, and it still just talked about smoke detectors. But over time, the technology had changed, and there is now a distinction between a smoke detector, which is a device that hooks up to a commercial fire alarm panel, and a smoke alarm, which is what we would use in our homes. It's freestanding, has its own power source quite often, and has its own sounding device. House Bill 2586 makes a distinction now between photoelectric smoke alarms and ionization smoke alarms, and that's necessary because the requirements that were imposed in the 97 law inadvertently excluded photoelectric smoke alarms from the Oregon market, and we need to have them available as a product. This House Bill 2586 provides some administrative rulemaking authority to the state fire marshal that didn't exist in the 97 law, and specifically to the issue of exempting hotels and motels that are protected by fire sprinkler systems from the requirements of the 97 law. Frankly, hotels and motels that are protected by fire sprinkler systems just are not the problem. And there, as Representative Leonard was saying, they've gone to some pretty high-tech means to provide fire and life safety in those, and they don't need to be covered by the 97 law. So this provides the fire marshal's office the opportunity to exempt them if they have fire sprinkler systems.
Well, then just a question.
Sure.
I'm just trying to remember, do we hear of major big hotel fires nowadays?
Yes, sir. They still occur almost annually somewhere. I mean, they pop up, not always in the United States. We've been fortunate. Our technology has moved ahead.
So with the technology, you can pretty much avert those?
Two things can occur, Mr. Chair. One is the fire sprinkler systems that most of the large hotels have gone to are putting these fires out before they're a problem. So they just never make the news. We just don't hear about them. The other is that where we have smoke alarms installed, fires may occur, and if there's no sprinkler system to put the fire out, at least we don't have the loss of life problem because the smoke alarms alert the occupants. They get out, fire department goes in and deals with the fire, and it just doesn't make the scale of the press to make the front page because there isn't a large loss of life. The 1997 law made an exception from its requirements for the manufactured housing industry. There was some concern during the interim that perhaps that wasn't as clear as everyone needed it to be, so House Bill 2586 will clarify that exception for the manufactured housing industry, and that's made because the manufactured housing industry operates under federal housing and urban development, HUD regulations, and in all states they build to those standards, Oregon included. So we leave it to the HUD standards to deal with those issues. And quite frankly, the HUD standards are coming around to this very technology that Oregon made the standard in 1997. So the manufactured housing industry will catch up very shortly. There are some smoke alarms built for the hearing impaired. It is very difficult for those smoke alarms to meet these requirements as standalone units. They do exist, and hotels and motels are required to make them available. But to impose the hush feature and the 10-year battery requirements on them, frankly, it's such a small part of the market, the industry just won't build them. And it's really not a problem because the technology, the smoke alarms are available by law now, have been for 15 or 20 years in Oregon, and most hotels and motels now are going to install systems, and that the strobes, like you see behind you on the wall, strobes and horns, and the smoke alarm requirements for the hearing impaired are being met in other ways. Representative Leonard mentioned the issue of smoke alarms being sold for shipment out of state, and that occurs two ways. One is there is a very large manufacturer of smoke alarms and smoke detectors in Tualatin, and technically under the 97 law, what they're building to send out of state and selling, they have to be very careful how they sell those and how they handle the bill of sale because they can become in violation of the 97 law. Also, there's a lot of distributors who buy from major manufacturers in other states and bring the smoke alarms into Oregon. Then they'll have, for instance, an electrical distributor in Portland may have a large electrical contractor in Vancouver, Washington as a customer, and they show up to buy cases of smoke alarms to put in an apartment complex in Washington, and they have to sell them Oregon-compliant smoke alarms. Now, that's not a bad idea, and perhaps Washington will catch up with this on one of these days, but for the time being, it creates a problem for the wholesalers, and so this will make an exception for those being sold out of state, for shipment out of state. Then there are RV or recreational vehicles, commercial vehicles, railroad equipment, aircraft, and marine vessels. They have a whole different technology for smoke alarms. And as the 97 law was written, they have to comply with these requirements, and it's just not available that way. So again, that's one of the issues that was developed by the stakeholders and is clarified in House Bill 2586. House Bill 2586 made selling non-compliant smoke alarms a crime. And as we know, district attorneys are very busy with very big crimes, and probably we're going to find it difficult to get them to deal with a retailer who sells a non-compliant smoke alarm. So House Bill 2586 changes that from a crime to a civil violation to be handled by the state fire marshal's office under civil penalty rules. Finally, this bill directs the Department of Consumer Business Services, DCBS, who does the building code, to modify the building codes, in, especially as it's specific to smoke alarms, to deal with some nuisance false alarming issues and to reduce the incidence of nuisance false alarming. That's sort of a companion to having the hush feature. And that is in the process. The Fire Marshal's Office has provided proposed changes to those codes, and they're working their way through the process at this time. Oregon has been a leader in a lot of important issues for a very long time. We can look at the Beach Bill. We can look at the Bottle Bill. We can look at Oregon's original smoke alarms, which date back to the 1970s, smoke alarm laws, which date back to the 1970s. Oregon led the way in providing that protection to its citizens. Senate Bill 874 took those laws a step further, and it's as significant as they set a landmark piece of legislation, an important improvement in, if you will, raising the standard of protection for citizens in Oregon. House Bill 2586, which is literally a housekeeping bill, resolves those unintended consequences with solutions that have been developed through a very lengthy and involved stakeholder process, and I respectfully urge your support of House Bill 2586.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And thanks very much. Does it apply also to public buildings? You're talking about the residential apartments, but not commercial. But does it cover a public building?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynn, no, it does not. Those use smoke detectors hooked up to fire alarm panels, and the power and the silencing features are provided there at the fire alarm panel. So it isn't necessary for this law to apply to those which go in retail, warehouses, factories, those type of installations.
Yes, but to the private rental.
This is specific to residents, yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? You know, at this point, what I'd like to do, Representative, did you have anything else you want to add? I would like to recess this hearing for just a moment, open a public hearing on 2634 for a minute while Representative Cheverly is here.
I have plenty of time, so we'll go right ahead.
Okay, just stand by then. We're recessing the public hearing on 2586. I'm going to open a public hearing on 2634 for the purpose of hearing for Representative Shetterly, because I know you have a 3:30 appointment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the accommodation. And members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, representative for District 34. House Bill 2634 is a very simple bill. It covers all of two lines of text. What it does, though, I think is very significant. It repeals the Oregon Anti-Apartheid Act of 1987. This was a bill that was received very well in the House as an opportunity for us to look back on a period of not very recent, that is, not too distant history, and remark very favorably on how things have changed in our world, in our relationship to that part of the world, in particular being South Africa. Testimony was presented to the House committee about the not only the political but the economic advances that have been made in South Africa since the repeal of the apartheid laws, and how at this point America is in fact the South Africa's number one foreign investor, and a new relationship that we both as a state and as part of the United States have with South Africa. It was sort of just a gift, I think, that this bill was suggested to me to have the opportunity to introduce it. But I hope that in the Senate as well, it'll be an opportunity to remark that how we get tied up in knots sometimes about issues that we find to be controversial and difficult. But to get a little perspective and see that there are some tremendous things happening, not only in our part of the world, but in other parts of the world as well, that things are moving in the right direction. And I think this is an opportunity to acknowledge that, the fact that we can say that we don't need the anti-apartheid law anymore, and this gives us an opportunity to repeal that. And that's really all I have to say for the bill.
And I understand that Representative Bowman would like to also
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding she is going to be down at some point today to testify on behalf of this as well. She testified in the House Committee and spoke very well on the floor about this as well.
Okay, okay. Any questions for the Chair? Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm going to recess the hearing on 2634 and return from recess and the hearing continues on 2586. Thank you very much for your patience. Could we know the part? Yes.
Before we go, can I just acknowledge the gentleman?
Yes, there. Mr. Senator Lim, would you please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gentleman sitting in the corner right and corner over there, he's perhaps a Dane. He's an inmate. And she's have been staying with me almost all day and working with me, sitting on the Senate floor. She's observing what's going on in the Senate. So he's my guest and friend. I invited him to see the process, what's going on in here.
Thank you very much. Thank you and welcome. It's good to see you again. We saw you this morning on the Senate floor. It's good to have you with us in the committee. All right. Yes. Jim, Jim Crawford, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Crawford. I'm the Fire Marshal for the City of Portland. I'm also the first Vice President of the International Fire Marshals Association. I've submitted some written testimony here for you, and out of respect for your valuable time, I'd rather not read it, but simply recap the points that have already been made.
Very much appreciated.
That is that this is current law. We've had experience with this for about a year and a half. That we believe that there are plenty of options for the consumer, that there are a number of manufacturers who are willing to stand behind their products and warranty them for this period, and that ultimately these products with the 10-year battery are going to prove to be less expensive over the long term than changing batteries out every year or sometimes twice a year, as many currently recommend. So this is a technical fix that we would like to see you support and pass out to the Senate floor with a due pass record.
Thank you. Any questions for the
How much would it cost a 10-year battery?
A 10-year battery with a hush feature can run anywhere from about $15, $16 and probably less than that depending on if you get them in bulk or not. And I would say upwards to maybe $20 for a smoke detector.
It could be one of the very expensive features for those people who have 100 or 50 rooms of apartment. It might be costly for them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, actually, I won't speak for them. Obviously, I can't speak for them. But I believe if you check, and if you haven't already heard from them, you'll hear that the Multifamily Housing Council and the Oregon Apartment Association both support this legislation and did in the previous session, because they view disabling detectors as much more of a liability problem for them than the expense of changing them out, and they want to see this fixed as well.
Okay.
Correct, Mr. Chair, if I could reemphasize
the law is in place already.
What the Fire Marshal Crawford just said is very true. Actually, Emily Cedarlace from the Multifamily Housing Council, I don't know if she's here, was instrumental in drafting the law in its current form, and she has become actually very protective of it because she views it as a law that actually protects her clients, those with own multifamily housing units, from having to answer some hard questions. There's nothing more difficult than at 3 in the morning to be called and said and told, you have an apartment that just caught on fire and unfortunately the tenant perished and the smoke detector wasn't working. We have some questions for you. That's a very uncomfortable position, and they recognize that and have been strong supporters.
Sure, that would be. Any other questions?
Sure. Do you know of opposition to this measure? What does the opposition say and why do they oppose it?
And that's why in my opening remarks I was trying to be very clear. There is opposition from some of the battery manufacturers who challenge whether or not there are any such things as 10-year batteries. There have been, first of all, to be real clear, I would not put my name on a bill requiring a 10-year battery that would end up causing
our citizens to have faith that they were installing a smoke detector that was going to last 10 years if there were any chance it would fail and before that 10 years and cause somebody to perish in the fire. So I have looked at all of the various studies that have been conducted, and I'm convinced, as are my colleagues in the fire service, who are actually a lot more technically smart than I am, that these absolutely are 10-year batteries. But secondly, and more importantly, the criticism is misplaced because they weren't at the table, although we had a large table. 2 years ago when we developed this law, they weren't there to bring up whatever concerns they had at that time. So the law passed, governor signed it, and then they were critical of the requirement for a 10-year battery. Well, that's what I was trying to emphasize to you. That's not what this bill deals with. This bill deals with some technical corrections to a law that's in place. So their criticism is about a law that really isn't up for debate this session.
Okay, but is there any validity in their criticism?
Absolutely none.
Other questions? Yes, I'm going to ask Ed Wilson to come on over and run to the chair.
I don't have time to read the bill, but the bill requires a 10-year battery? Or?
No, sir.
No.
Okay, so I would say...
Current law. It already does.
Okay. The law we passed, Senate Bill 874 in the 1997, is what requires a 10-year battery and the hush feature. This bill only makes technical corrections to that law.
Okay.
It does not deal with a 10-year battery. That's okay. Already law.
Thank you.
Come on up. Ed's another colleague of mine, so if you don't mind, I'll...
Sure.
Actually,
no. What about Burton? Burton, do you want to come on up too? Burton's from Oregon Fire District Association.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Ed Wilson and I were hired together in Portland Fire Bureau, hired the first day, went through training together. He obviously took a much more lucrative path than I did. And I'm trying to catch up to him now, but I think it's too late.
Obviously, he was much younger when he started, too. But
I'm actually still young. I mean, he has all this gray hair.
Well, I have great appreciation. Where do you have your from?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ed Wilson, Division Chief of the Portland Fire Bureau and current President of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2586, which has the full support of the Portland Fire Bureau, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee. I'm not here to speak on the technical aspects of the bill as a fix to last session's legislation. Others are here to do that. Instead, my intent is to communicate to the immeasurable value of having working smoke alarms in homes and the important role this and last session's bill, Senate Bill 874, play in protecting life and property. The simple fact is that smoke alarms save lives. As professional firefighters, when we arrive at fires and people are at home, we can usually tell immediately if the home had a functioning smoke alarm. The family is usually safe outside in the front lawn waiting for us. The ugly flip side of this is that when no one is out front waiting for us, it usually means that we will find bodies inside, adults and children, and due to the lack of a working smoke alarm. When smoke alarms are present in fatal fires, we almost always find that the battery in the unit is either dead or disconnected. Early detection is the foremost line of defense against death, injury, and property loss. I firmly believe that the HUS feature addressed in this legislation will result in saved lives, since it will mean that batteries are not removed due to cooking smoke or other low-level generating activities. Additionally, the long-life batteries will help ensure that a working battery is in place for years to guard against fire. Oregon Fire Services are united in their support of this measure, and we hope that you will support it as well as an effort to keep Oregon out front as a leader in fire and life safety. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For sweet.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Burton Weist. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, and the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee. To be brief, we are obviously in support of this measure, and I would raise one issue with you, and that is that with Measure 50 and many of the other actions that have taken to limit the resources of fire departments, we have had to look more and more to preventive measures to save people's lives instead of being able to always have the right equipment and be able to get there as quickly as we would like. So smoke detectors, sprinklers, and all kinds of other these kind of devices.
Burton's from Oregon Fire District Directors Association.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Ed Wilson and I were hired together in the former fire bureau, hired the first day, went through training together. He obviously took a much more lucrative path than I did. And I'm trying to catch up to him now, but I think it's too late.
Obviously, he was much younger when he started, too.
I'm actually still young. I've been caused all these gray hairs.
Well, I have great appreciation. Where do you have your frost?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ed Wilson, Division Chief of the Portland Fire Bureau and current President of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2586, which has the full support of the Portland Fire Bureau, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee. I'm not here to speak on the technical aspects of the bill as a fix to last session's legislation. Others are here to do that. Instead, my intent is to communicate to the immeasurable value of having working smoke alarms in homes and the important role this and last session's bill, Senate Bill 874, play in protecting life and property. The simple fact is that smoke alarms save lives. As professional firefighters, when we arrive at fires and people are at home, we can usually tell immediately if the home had a functioning smoke alarm. The family is usually safe outside in the front lawn waiting for us. The ugly flip side of this is that when no one is out front waiting for us, it usually means that we will find bodies inside, adults and children, and due to the lack of a working smoke alarm. When smoke alarms are present in fatal fires, we almost always find that the battery in the unit is either dead or disconnected. Early detection is the foremost line of defense against death, injury, and property loss. I firmly believe that the HUS feature addressed in this legislation will result in saved lives, since it will mean that batteries are not removed due to cooking smoke or other low-level generating activities. Additionally, the long-life batteries will help ensure that a working battery is in place for years to guard against fire. Oregon's fire services are united in their support of this measure, and we hope that you will support it as well as an effort to keep Oregon out front as a leader in fire and life safety. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reese.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Burton Weiss. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, and the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee. To be brief, we are obviously in support of this measure, and I would raise one issue with you, and that is that with Measure 50 and many of the other actions that have taken to limit the resources of fire departments, we have had to look more and more to preventive measures to save people's lives instead of being able to always have the right equipment and be able to get there as quickly as we would like. So smoke detectors, sprinklers, and all kinds of other these kind of devices have become more and more important to the fire service as we've gone on. We have had some small rural districts where they have lost as much as 50% of their property tax revenue, and we don't have fees that we can go generate like other local governments do to cover those losses. So that means we absolutely have to have strong laws that deal with smoke detectors and those kind of features, that it can at least save lives if we have trouble responding. So this bill is incredibly important to us, and I would only conclude by emphasizing what Representative Leonard said, and that is the law is already on the books, but this bill is absolutely necessary to make this law work well, and I hope you don't forget that. We absolutely have to have a bill if we're going to make this work well, and the fire service has spent a tremendous amount of time doing everything possible to make this bill do the job, and we desperately need your support for the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for either Mr. West or Mr. East? Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Representative. Brian Bowe and Russ Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this afternoon representing the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. We refer to it as NEMA. NEMA, the dry cell battery section, represents the battery interests that are affected by House Bill 2586. I want to begin my comments this afternoon by stressing that the National Electrical Manufacturers Association has no quarrel with the intent of House Bill 2586.
have the greatest and highest respect for our counterparts who deal with these life safety issues. They are important matters, and we take them very seriously. However, there are some policy and some practical implications to House Bill 2586 that we would like to share with you this afternoon. I'd like to start out by pointing out some of the problems and shortcomings as we see them with the bill. Beginning with the installation of battery-operated smoke alarms in homes, it's important to bear in mind that the major cause of fire-related deaths and injuries is the failure of some homeowners to install battery-operated smoke alarms. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, let me back up. I'm going to paraphrase the testimony of Raymond Balfour that's been handed out to you. I apologize for that. I got ahead of myself. Mr. Balfour retired as of Friday, and I'm going to paraphrase his remarks from the House hearing. Again, the major cause of fire-related deaths is the failure of homeowners to install battery-operated smoke alarms. This bill does not address that problem. Another serious problem is the one of battery removal. A major cause of death and injuries is from the removal of batteries from installed smoke alarms. This bill does nothing to address that problem. As the previous witnesses explained to you, there are two different types of smoke alarms, photoelectric and ionization. It was discovered after the original bill was passed, in some haste, I might add, that photoelectric alarms draw more power than any currently commercially available battery could provide for a 10-year period. So the bill exempts them. There is the belief that ionization smoke alarms can be powered for 10 years, and I'd like to address that in a moment. Another aspect of the bill that gives us concerns is the mandating of hush mechanisms, the hush buttons on smoke alarms. Section 12, sub 2 of the bill would require that all ionization smoke alarms sold in Oregon include a hush mechanism that allows a person to temporarily disengage the alarm for a period of not more than 15 minutes. While we agree that it is desirable to have hush buttons on smoke alarms, which are installed in certain locations, we also agree with others who believe that it is unwise and unsafe to require hush buttons to be included on all smoke alarms, regardless of where they are positioned. This view has not changed as the requirement for hush buttons is on ionization or photoelectric. And what we're referencing here is the concern that, while a smoke detector with a hush button may be desirable in an environment like the kitchen, it raises some questions if you put that same smoke alarm in a bedroom. And you may have some individuals who may be impaired from substance abuse, from drinking, or drug use, and alarm goes off, and in an impaired state, they push the hush button, and only to find that they've delayed an alarm when they should have gotten out of the house to their ultimate injury or death. Another issue that is something that we think has to be considered in this area is the one of maintenance of smoke alarms. Currently, homeowners are encouraged to change the batteries once every year, and in that same period of time, perform basic maintenance on the smoke alarm, such as cleaning out any dust, debris, insects, or other matter. If you have 10-year smoke alarms, there is the possibility of substantial accumulation of debris in the alarm, and over that period of time, it is unknown how that may affect the alarm's performance. This also brings up the issue of reliability. There currently is no conclusive data on the reliability of smoke alarms over a 10-year period. And now the part that I'd like to focus on that Representative Leonard referred to earlier was about this controversy over what constitutes a 10-year battery and does one exist. I respect Representative Leonard greatly, but I would disagree with him that there is no valid data to the contrary, that there may be an issue at this point. And I'll refer to the written testimony on page 2 under 10-year battery requirement. 9-volt lithium batteries are now being sold with a warranty that they will provide 10 years of service in ionization smoke alarms. And in apparent advanced compliance of the bill's proposed requirement, some ionization smoke alarms that are solely battery-operated are already being packaged with these batteries. The manufacturers of the smoke alarms say are they're repeating and passing along the 10-year guarantee for a battery. It is our belief of several of these major battery manufacturers, and also the belief of several major battery manufacturers, that existing 9-volt lithium batteries will not provide 10 years of service in ionization smoke alarms. Let me explain. Attached to this written testimony is a copy of information provided by Ultralife Batteries entitled 9-Volt Lithium Batteries, Service Life Analysis and Ionization Smoke Alarms. And this is attachment one that you will see immediately behind these written comments. Page 2 of the information states that the total current drain rate of ionization-type smoke alarms is calculated by adding together the individual current drain rates of four separate activities of the device. This information contains mathematical calculations to show you how much the battery's initial capacity is removed each year by each of the four separate activities. Then divide the claimed initial capacity by the sum of four individual drain rates to arrive at the calculated number of years of service. As the final step, this calculated number is reduced to take shelf life losses into account. At the end of these calculations, Ultralife claims that this 9-volt lithium battery will provide 12.3 years of service if the batteries are discharged to 7.8 volts and 13 years of service if the batteries are discharged to 7.2 volts. The largest of the four individual current drain rates is what is called the quiescent current, which powers the smoke alarm circuit continuously. The Ultralife materials assume the quiescent current reduces battery capacity by 60.57 ohms a year. When I wrote, when Mr. Balfour wrote to North American Detectors to ask about the quiescent current in ionization smoke alarms manufactured by that company, NADI replied that the quiescent current in its least power-hungry ionization alarms reduced battery capacity by 1.427 a year. That is substantially more than the figures that were used to arrive at this calculation. By simply substituting that manufacturer's number of 114.27 for Ultralife's assumed number of 65.7, and using all of the other numbers supplied by Ultralife in the methodology, we calculated that Ultralife's battery would provide only 8.33 years of service in the least power-hungry model operated ionization smoke alarm. And if you look also behind the material on the Ultralife power drain rates, is a series of email correspondences from these manufacturers that confirm these calculations.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. You're talking to the existing law, not necessarily to the changes in the bill. Do you have amendments to change the existing law?
Well, yes, Senator, Chairman Duncan, Senator Crowe, yes, we would suggest that, we will suggest amendments.
Have you got them drawn up?
I do not have them in LC form. Let's turn for a minute to the matter of the 10-year battery warranty and what is claimed by the manufacturer of a 10-year battery warranty. Emphasis has been given to the fact that Ultralife gives a 10-year warranty with its 9-volt lithium batteries. According to the Ultralife limited warranty, a copy of which is attached, Ultralife's liability is limited to the replacement of the battery or the repair or replacement of the defective product, and in no case shall Ultralife's liability under any other remedy prescribed by law exceed the purchase price of the battery. According to the warranty statement, Ultralife shall have no liability for any personal injury, property damage, or special incidental contingent or consequential damages of any kind resulting from a fire. And that warranty is attached to your testimony as attachment 3, the last page of this testimony. Mr. Chair, what we believe, and I recognize that a lot of this information is technical, and I've gone through it as quickly as I could, and I am not an electrical engineer, and it probably my comments and familiarity with the material reveal that. But it is important, and I want to emphasize to the committee, that we took the drain rates provided by three different smoke alarm manufacturers and simply used the same calculations and methodologies that Ultralife used to produce the calculations that say this battery will last 10 years. Nowhere has anyone run a test on that battery for 10 continuous years. There's been no practical test. It's purely a mathematical conjecture based on these assumptions. When you replace them with the data that these manufacturers supplied us, the batteries don't last 10 years. They last 8.33 years. And we want you to be aware of that as you make a decision on this bill. If that's the case, so be it. But be aware that it's questionable, given the smoke alarms that are out there, whether these batteries will actually last 10 years. A second thing that I want to point out before I close my testimony, Mr. Chair, is I'd like you to look at the testimony marks First Alert.
Okay.
Now, First Alert manufactures a 10-year smoke alarm, but they were opposed to this bill. And there's some interesting reasons for being opposed to the bill. First and foremost, they don't believe that it gets at the critical objective, which is getting smoke detectors into homes without smoke detectors, and that's their first concern. Secondly, I'd like you to look on the second page. There's a photocopy of the First Alert brochure. Now, Bob Garrison from the Fire Marshal's office a moment ago in his testimony said that it was appropriate to exempt photoelectric alarms because they were good technology that should be kept available. I want you to consider what technology and the attributes of some of that technology that will not be available if we don't change Section 12 in House Bill 2586. The general use First Alert smoke alarm here is the only alarm on these pages that we provided for you that would be allowed for sale in Oregon under this law. The alarm right below it is a remote flashlight testing alarm, which is used
again for the one that would be
the second one right here. That's marked SA908.
Mm-hmm.
Remote flashlight testing. Extremely important for handicapped or physically impaired people because instead of having to get up on a chair or a ladder and test the smoke alarm, it allows them to test it with a flashlight. The manufacturer, First Alert, is concerned that it will not last 10 years because the drain rates are different from supplying those features. On the second page, another one that I think is very important for the committee to be aware of, in the bottom left-hand corner of the page, SA150B, it's game light model. This is a unit that when the smoke alarm goes off, a light goes off to provide light for passage in areas that may not have a light available or and other situations in a house that is a desirable feature. That unit will effectively be banned from sale in Oregon. And we don't see, these are proven life-saving technologies that have features that are very important to some homeowners, and we don't see how public policy is advanced to that, such a degree that they should be banned from availability in Oregon.
Sure.
Are they already banned by existing law?
Yes, they are, under existing law.
Okay.
But the existing law, Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, the existing law was rather flawed in its original iteration, and I don't believe it has been actively enforced.
The, as I understand the content of this bill, it just doesn't change existing law very much, but it takes care of some unintended consequences. You would like to use this bill as a vehicle to change existing law? Is that what you'd like to do?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, we would, to the extent that Representative Leonard referenced that we weren't part of the original discussion. And that is true. And while that is regrettable, I have to let the committee know that dry cell battery issues are rather arcane and obscure. I've represented NEMA on some environmental issues having to do with mercury and batteries on and off for the last 10 years. They don't retain me as ongoing counsel because these issues are obscure and seldom arise. This bill was passed out late in the session. There were no other battery bills. So unfortunately, no one from the industry was at the table, and this did become law. But I think you can see that, you know, there wasn't a lot of input on these issues, or we wouldn't be back here exempting photoelectric alarms that, you know, otherwise currently available technology at the time the bill was originally passed. If there would have been input from all the parties, a lot of these rather glaring errors wouldn't have taken place. So while we are requesting to change existing law, in many ways, we feel this is the first time that these issues have been raised. And with that, let me add one other remark. Speaking to the stakeholders group and the work that was done on these issues prior to this legislative session, the industry was represented in those. However, the information attached to this that provides how Ultralife arrived at the conclusion that their battery lasts 10 years was not submitted to us until late December of 98. So we were not able to undertake this research and these matters of evaluating the data and the claims until right prior to this session began. So we weren't able to discuss those matters in the work group setting because that information had not been provided.
Is that you like say that this was a 10-year battery? But
they, and Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, they claim they warranty it to last 10 years. But, and that's where the issue of the warranty becomes important, because the fire marshal is saying we're relying on the warranty. As long as the manufacturer says the warranty, the battery lasts 10 years, that's good enough for us, and that constitutes a 10-year battery. Because there is no existing UL or other standard for what is a 10-year battery. But look at the warranty. The warranty says that if the battery doesn't last 10 years, you get a new battery. Nothing else. They'll either give you a new battery or the purchase price of the battery.
You know, assuming that's the case, then it's going to be somebody's responsibility to say to people or to put these things in about 7 years, you better be careful about this because, you know, these things may last 10 years, but they may not, and so you need to be careful about them. But does that, even if you need to do that, and I'm sure the fire marshal's office can do that, or somebody can, do you need to change the law?
I don't know that you need, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe.
They're advertising things as 10-year batteries. I suppose you call them 10-year batteries because they call them 10-year batteries, even if they last on the average 8.33 years.
Well, we believe that's an inherent problem with the existing law that would be remedied by deleting Section 12 of the current bill. And we believe that that poses serious problems. We think our science is valid. We think our calculations are valid that we have run on this battery, on its performance standards. And frankly, we think there ought to be given additional time for the normal course to be run. That is standard-setting organizations that battery manufacturers and smoke alarm manufacturers participate in that arrive through a consensus process that say, okay, now we all agree that this battery lasts 10 years in these smoke alarms. That hasn't happened, and that may well happen over the next couple of years because this issue has been brought to the forefront, but it hasn't happened yet.
Okay, Brian, I guess you were talking about one at the table at one point. I guess what I'm thinking right now, have your technical people sat down with fire marshals and fire chiefs, and has this discussion gone on with them?
Mr. Chair,
nodding their heads in the back of the room.
Yes, it has, to the extent that the discussion could go on during those work groups. We had not been provided with the technical data, but Mr. Steve Wazinski for Duracell, who is a PhD in this area, was participated in those meetings.
Okay, I'll be right there.
Yes.
Okay. Would you please identify yourself, Mr. Oates, again? Russ Spencer, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer on behalf of Duracell, and I will abbreviate my remarks because of the very good job that Mr. Bowe did in articulating the issues. I guess I would start off again by echoing what Mr. Bowe said, and respectfully to the Honorable Senator from Portland. Our client was not represented at that point. I guess that's their problem. But this is an open process, and when the problem has been identified and realized, I think it's appropriate to come forward.
Sure. Russ, who is your client?
Duracell. Duracell North Atlantic, a battery manufacturer. We make 9-volt. We make a variety of batteries, but the 9-volt batteries you see commonly in smoke detectors up until last year would be one of our products. We have a number of concerns. Now, why do we care? One of the reasons we care is a business concern. You have taken an existing proven life safety technology that has saved thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of lives and said, okay, that's illegal here. We're not going to sell that anymore. Our product, how is that? Yes, we have an absolute business concern. We also believe there's a legitimate public policy and public safety issue here. We believe that it would be appropriate, as Mr. Bowe has said, to let the standard-making process run its course rather than leaping ahead of the established standard-making process and saying we're just going to put our faith in the word of a single-source manufacturer. There is currently, I believe, and I may be wrong on this, but I believe only one manufacturer who produces and wants a 10-year battery. We sell Ultralife's product. We will buy their batteries and put our label on it and sell it, but we will not warrant it as a 10-year battery. There are a number of manufacturers and other battery manufacturers who have stated that by the way, they make a fine product. The question is it a 10-year battery or isn't it? I don't know. I'm not qualified to make that decision. I would submit to you that nobody in this room really knows if it's a 10-year battery or not. So let's let the scientific process take its course. If I had known in advance, a little further in advance, that the bill would be up today, I would have brought, as Brian said, Dr. Steve Wyslinski, who has a PhD in electrical engineering from Massachusetts Institute of Technology here. He is a Duracell employee. He would submit to you and would be willing to prove under his, what he believes is scientific pure reasoning, that no, it's not. Mr. Chairman, again, bottom line, trying to be brief here, nobody knows if it's a 10-year battery or not. If they don't know, then why are we rushing ahead? I again disagree respectfully with Senator Leonard. I think there is validity to the criticism. I think it is an area of disagreement and should be pursued further. And finally, I guess I would ask that should the committee choose to proceed with this, that it would at a very minimum be appropriate to attach some form of reporting mechanism back to legislative assembly, perhaps not the next one because there won't be time, but perhaps in 2003. On the implementation of this program and what we're finding out is happening. Bare minimum, that is a responsibility that this committee ought to assign.
Any questions?
Sure. Yes. Your suggestion for amendment was simply to delete Section 12, but isn't that of the existing law? That would change the existing law and would do away with both the requirements for the 10-year battery and the hush feature, right?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Trump correct, and that would simply create a free market situation where consumers have the opportunity to choose between products.
You'd go back to what had been the status quo before the passage of the bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Trump, yes. With a proven life savings.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you for now.
Thank you.
Okay, Joe Brewer. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. I'm here today. The Building Codes Division is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2586. As with all attempts to work on issues in the interim, we worked very hard with Fire Marshal's Office, with Representative Leonard, to ensure that all of the technical amendments that were necessary were addressed. Obviously, I'm here today with a few that are being recommended, but not to confuse the committee, we're removing these from the table on the basis of an agreement with Fire Marshal's Office that these issues would be addressed administratively. What I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is none of these issues are really to die for, and we're simply trying to clarify matters here. We don't want to slow the process down.
These are LC right now being drafted, the amendments?
No, Mr. Chairman. These are amendments that we offered in the House and were discussed. And through some confusion, we're not addressed. And at the same time, the Department doesn't feel as though these are significant enough to slow down this important legislation. And we're going to work with the Fire Marshal's Office during the interim to address our concerns.
Why don't we, this is point if you want, but we could go ahead and, because I think we have some questions to come back to. We could ask for these amendments to be dropped if you want. Members of the committee, do you want to ask the committee to order?
Well, I don't know. We haven't heard anything about them. We don't know what they are. I wouldn't ask until we knew more about them.
And again, Mr. Chairman, the department, this was prepared legislation. I discussed this issue with Representative Leonard in the Fire Marshal's Office in Iowa, office in the hallway. We're comfortable with addressing these during the interim and administrative role.
All right, yes.
Do these amendments deal with the same issues we just heard from Spencer and Bo?
Through the chair, Senator, no, Senator Trow, these are strictly clarification.
So these are other little issues. Okay.
Exactly.
And can be handled administratively.
Right.
What do you think about the argument that a 10-year battery is an 8.33-year battery on average? What does that do if it's in the law and it says something about 10 years? What does that do if it really doesn't last that long?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trow, I am not a graduate electrical engineer either, and we have been at the table during the interim for those discussions. I'm not certain, to be honest.
Let me ask the fire marshal. If that's the problem, what are we going to do to alert people who buy these things thinking they'll last 10 years and they're only going to last 8.33 years on average? What do we need to do about that? Anything?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trell, for the record, I'm Robert Garrison with the State Fire Marshal's Office. There's really two pieces to the response.
Go back to what had been the status quo before the passage of the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Trell, yes. With a proven life savings.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay,
thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, Joe Brewer. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. I'm here today. The Building Codes Division is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2586. As with all attempts to work on issues in the interim, we worked very hard with Fire Marshal's Office, with Representative Leonard, to ensure that all of the technical amendments that were necessary were addressed. Obviously, I'm here today with a few that are being recommended, but we not to confuse the committee, we're removing these from the table on the basis of an agreement with Fire Marshal's Office that these issues would be addressed administratively. What I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is none of these issues are really to die for, and we're simply trying to clarify matters here. We don't want to slow the process down.
These are LC right now being drafted, the amendments?
No, Mr. Chairman. These are amendments that we offered in-house and were discussed. And through some confusion, we're not addressed. And at the same time, the department doesn't feel as though these are significant enough to slow down this important legislation. And we're going to work with the Fire Marshal's Office during the interim to address our concerns.
Why don't we, this is point if you want, so we could go ahead and, because I think we have some questions to come back to, we could ask for these amendments to be dropped as well. Members of the committee, do you want to ask the committee?
Well, I don't know. We haven't heard anything about them. We don't know what they are. I wouldn't ask until we knew more about them.
And again, Mr. Chairman, the department, this was prepared legislation. I discussed this issue with Representative Leonard in the Fire Marshal's Office and Iowa office in the hallway. We're comfortable with addressing these during the interim and administrative role.
All right.
Do these amendments deal with the same issues we just heard from Spencer and Bo?
Through the chair, Senator, no, Senator Trow, these are strictly clarification.
So these are other little issues. Okay.
Okay.
And can be handled administratively.
Right.
What do you think about the argument that a 10-year battery is an 8.33-year battery on average? What does that do? If it's in the law and it says something about 10 years, what does that do if it really doesn't last that long?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trow, I am not a graduate electrical engineer either, and we have been at the table during the interim for those discussions. I'm not certain, to be honest.
Let me ask the fire marshal. If that's the problem, what are we going to do to alert people who buy these things thinking they'll last 10 years and only want to last 8.33 years on average? What do we need to do about that? Anything?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, for the record, I'm Robert Garrison with the State Fire Marshal's Office. There's really two pieces to the response to that. The first is, following the hearings in the House, when the issue of some battery testing arose, the manufacturer of the battery went out and bought 19 smoke alarms off the shelf and submitted them to a testing lab and found that of the 19, 15 did in fact pass pass muster, if you will, for that quiescent draw issue and would last 10 or more years. They have ongoing testing in progress that is now about 7 or 8 years old, which continues to indicate that these batteries can last well beyond 10 years. In fact, it's interesting that one of the products from BRK, the one that has the escape light and the remote flashlight test, its quiescent draw in the tests that were run by an independent testing laboratory after the hearings in the House in fact, is lower than the mark at which the 10-year battery is deemed to be 10 or more years. We don't consider that to be an issue. There are a long list of smoke alarms available that have gone back to Underwriters Laboratory for a waiver on their battery requirements that allows them to package them and sell them as a 10-year smoke alarm. So we don't see a concern there. We believe they will, and they're warranted to last that way. So that's sort of response one. The other piece of the response is I want to keep in mind, as with any product, we will occasionally have failures. Any smoke alarm will occasionally, with what we have now, the smoke alarm batteries are intended to last a year, sometimes more. But all of these smoke alarms are required to be manufactured with a device in them that senses the battery level. And when it gets below an acceptable standard that's established by Underwriters Laboratory, the smoke alarm begins to emit a warning chirp. And it will do that for a period of a few weeks so that people have the opportunity to hear and know about it. So
at 8.333, it's going to start doing that.
If in fact, Mr. Cherry, if in fact that this, what we thought was a 10-year battery, got to 8.3 and decided it wasn't going to make it, the smoke alarm would alert the owner to the fact that the battery needs to be replaced. Just what we have today.
Any other questions for Mr. Garrison before I move to the next one? Okay. We have... Mr. Barrow, is yours brief testimony or?
I'd be happy to have you move to the testimony.
I think I will. I think I'm going to recess the hearing on House Bill 2586 again and open the hearing on House Bill 2634. And Representative Bowman, welcome to our committee. It's glad to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon. For the record, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, state representative. I represent District 19. I am here today to speak in support of House Bill 2634, which is the bill that would repeal Oregon's Anti-Apartheid Act of 1987. When we had this bill in the House, Representative Shetterly asked if I wanted to come and testify on this particular bill, and I did, because I thought as we were talking about repealing this Apartheid Act, it's really useful for us to reflect on some of the things we could possibly learn from the repeal of apartheid in South Africa. Some of those things, like what's been fascinating for me is just watching how they developed their constitution. We have a constitution now that includes over 42 different languages in their constitution, and it was very purposeful to ensure that every individual felt that the constitution represented them. If you look at their education system, we still are challenged with how do we integrate our education system here so that all people feel welcomed and appreciated. However, in South Africa, they have been able to integrate their education system and have kids of all different colors go to school together and have had not one incident, not one, of any kind of violent outbreak because people didn't want to go to school with somebody who didn't look like them. There are many, many, many lessons I believe we could learn from South Africa, and I think sometimes we pat ourselves on the back on what a great, wonderful job we do. And here's an opportunity for us to reflect and say, there's some things that we could learn. South Africa's been at it a lot less than we have, a lot less time than we have. But boy, they have some lessons they could sure teach us about equality and treating all people as equals and how you build a society that's all working towards the common good. And so with that, I will be happy to answer any questions and would urge your support and passage with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Bowman. Any questions for...
I have a question. Remember when this bill was passed, you know how Treasurer Jim Hill feels about it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, yes. As a matter of fact, when we first had this bill in the House, Treasurer Jim Hill was actually here there as well, testifying in favor. Okay. So he's very supportive of the repeal at this time.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see you guys. Look good.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2634 and resume the public hearing on 2586 and ask Mr. Barrels to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see very great.
My name
is Dave Barrows, and I represent Ultralife, the manufacturer of the 9-volt top-end 10-year battery. It's nice to see all of you again. many folks behind me. let me just make two or three observations.
You handled it all very well.
Thank you.
And I won't have to spend so much energy depending on the thing.
If I may just make a couple of three quick points, Mr. Chairman. Being passed out is a letter, a four-page letter from Mr. Garrison that was written in response to much of what Mr. Balfour and Mr. Bowe said to the House Committee. It's a lengthy letter. It's more detailed than you maybe have time to look at, but it is an excellent response to much of what Mr. Bowe has said, and I will not take the committee's time at this point to go through it. There are a lot of 9-volt batteries produced, not all of them produced by a wide variety of companies, but they do purchase them from our company, relabel them, as was indicated by Mr. Spencer, and so many of the fire alarm first alert buys these 10-year batteries, and they put them in an alarm system that they warrant is good for 10 years. So the first alert folks, hand-wringing is sort of lost on me, to be honest with you. A lot of what we're talking about here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, frankly, is economic. The 10-year battery that popped into these fire alarms cost $6.99 on the shelf. If we all do what we've been taught to do by a Madison Avenue suggestion, and I don't mean that in a bad way, it's not a pejorative, it's just that was dreamed up by a marketing person for one battery company, which is change your clock, change your battery. Those batteries are warranted for more than a year, so why would we change them every 6 months? Well, the reason is you sell more batteries.
Okay.
And those batteries cost $3.99. Now, the issue was raised, and there were questions on the House side about whether or not this was a bad thing for this 10-year battery program was a bad thing for poor people. And the answer is, it is not. It's a cost saver. Because you can buy, in this state today, and I have purchased them, I've gone to Home Depot and purchased them, a 10-year battery hush feature smoke alarm for $9.99. Now, they were on sale, argument, from $11.99. But they are inexpensive. You can buy them a little more expensive, as was testified to, up to maybe around $20. But if you never have to replace the battery in that 10 years, and you are supposed to change your alarm, which I didn't realize until I got into this, you're supposed to actually take your alarm out of your, remove it after 10 years, regardless of whether it's a 1-year battery, 10 of them, or 20 batteries, or one 10-year battery, you're supposed to still take the alarm down and put a new one up. That's what you're supposed to do. So the fact of the matter is that it is much less expensive to the consumer to have the system we have in Oregon today. And all I would suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, is every professional that has appeared before you today, we've also given you the March 1999 Ultralife test, which was done by an independent firm in Arizona. And it's hard to, you know, this is all technical stuff that none of us are at least I'm not certainly capable to analyze fully. But all I'm asking you to do, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is listen to the professionals, every one of whom said we have on the books today a far-reaching, visionary law. And as Representative former Senator Leonard said in his testimony in the House, did not say today, but he said it in the House, and that is that he has never seen a fire death in property where there was a working smoke alarm. He has seen fire deaths, but he has never seen one where there was a working smoke alarm. And I submit to you that the Oregon law, with its mandatory 10-year battery, and it doesn't
get pulled out to put in Johnny's Christmas toy. It doesn't get pulled out because it's making them some noise because of the smoke and forgotten to put back in. But the system we have today is going to become, especially if you pass this modification and cleanup bill, will become the national model. It is already being discussed in other legislatures in this country, and it will become, with these good changes to make it even better, the model bill in the country. And I appreciate the opportunity to address you. There's some other issues I could deal about, the liability, and you know, I have a letter from an attorney saying this. We're not limited in liability to the replacement cost of the battery. If we have a battery and it doesn't work, they can screw our pants off. And should be able to. Not suggesting they shouldn't. So I thank the committee very much for allowing me to.
Question for Mr. Willis.
Sure.
Yes, thanks.
The modifications taking care of the unintended consequences that this bill does contain, the actual difference between this and the law. Tell me again what those things do and where you are on those.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd rather defer to Mr. Garrison specifically, because it was his work group that put these together.
Okay.
And we are very much in support of the bill, as presented to you, and it's brought to you by the House as unamended.
Are these changes that are in the bill, are they likely to affect other companies adversely?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tro, I don't think they will impact any company adversely. I think they will actually help some companies. The Hilton Hotel, as Mr. Garrison talked about, the manufacturer in Tualatin who employs 45 people.
So they will be helpful.
It will be helpful to all of them. I don't think it will hurt anybody, unless you can argue that the law that's currently on the books hurts people.
Yeah.
But this bill will help companies and I think not adversely impact anyone.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions, comments?
Do you want to just explain what the changes do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, kind of a long list, but I'm going to abbreviate that because
okay,
when I said it before,
a general description.
Right. What we do, first of all, is make a distinction between smoke alarms and smoke detectors.
Mm-hmm.
So we separate residential from commercial.
Okay.
We make a distinction between photoelectric and ionization smoke alarms.
Okay.
Because, as you've heard here, there is a problem with a 10-year power source for photoelectrics, and we need them on the market. We create some exceptions for some very small pieces of the market, if you will, smoke alarms for the hearing impaired, smoke alarms for trains and marine vessels and such. And we create that exception for sale of smoke alarms to go out of state to provide that relief so that we're not impacting other states where wholesalers in Oregon are shipping product to Washington or Idaho or California.
And then the question for hotels.
Mr. Chair, there are actually two others that I missed. One is it allows the fire marshal to exempt hotels and motels that are protected by fire sprinkler systems, because they're just not part of this problem at all anyway. And the other piece is where Senate Bill 874 made the sale of a non-complying smoke alarm a crime, House Bill 2586 converts that to a civil penalty process to take it out of the criminal realm.
And all of these, you think, are improvements in the existing law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, very much so, yes. And the stakeholders, I mean, this is all driven by the stakeholders. They agree.
Okay. I'm going to close the public here on 2586. I'm going to open a work session, not necessarily we have to lead to a session day, but I want to raise a couple of issues in the work session. Okay. I'm opening a work session on 2586. I guess the thing I want to raise, well, we have everyone in the room right now. At first, as I heard the discussion and Brian came up and so forth, I thought, well, maybe we need to get these people together and try to work it out. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you've already done that. You've all been together already. So we really would not be accomplishing anything by doing that. Okay, I guess the question for this committee, we have this particular bill before us. If we listen to Brian and Spencer, okay, their issue deals with a re-look at the 10-year warranty concept. I guess what I'm anxious to know if the committee
wants to look at that, or you want to just deal with the bill as it is?
Mr. Chair, I think we ought to deal with the bill as it is. I think it's ready to go, and we ought to move it along.
Senator Lamb.
I was out for a while, but for me, I think we should deal with the 10-year warranty issue also.
You want to deal with the 10-year? Now, that goes back and relooks at the bill.
Yes,
the past last session.
That's one of the issues we discussed right here.
That's the one Brian brought up. Okay.
I want to amend the bill to change the bill.
If it makes it better.
It doesn't. That's
well, I guess I don't know.
That's a matter of opinion.
I suspect that we won't even go there. Senator Shields, have you had an opportunity? I know you had to be out for a while. Did you hear enough of this discussion with the bill as it is? I am too. I guess I'm not anxious. I'm not anxious to relook at that through this mechanism at this point. I will take a motion.
Okay, sure. I move we send the Senate bill, what is the number?
2586
to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Is there discussion? Well, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Lynn?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Trow? Aye.
Chair Duncan?
Aye. House Bill 2586 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill?
I will.
Senator Troll will carry the bill. I close the work session on House Bill 2586. I'm going to open the work session.
Mr. Chair, just kind of a vote explanation there. Sometimes when you don't have time to comprehend everything totally, you go with the people you trust.
Yes.
And I trust all of my colleagues on the committee. Mayor Katz hauled me upstairs to beat on me for about a half an hour about last week's homeless bill. So I wasn't down here for the entire time, but I think that you guys did a good job with the bill, and I'm trusting you here.
Okay. By the way, I'm going to open a work session on April 2634.
Mr. Chair, I think we're ready for a motion on that.
Yes.
I'd move 20... You said 2634 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Shields moves House Bill 2630 floor to the floor. Shields moves House Bill 2630 floor to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yes, Senator.
I was here when we voted to implement the ban on apartheid and pass this legislation. It's really wonderful that things have changed enough so that we can vote to abolish it, to repeal it.
Yep. Things can work out, I'm sure. Other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynn.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator
Trump. Aye. House Bill 1325 amended. House Bill 2634 will be sent before the due pass recommendation. Anyone would like to carry that one?
I would.
Senator Shields will carry the bill. Closing the work session on House Bill 2634, opening a public hearing on House Bill 3334. And forward, how are you doing? And Rob. Rob, I wasn't sure which capacity you were here today. I kept looking for you on the other list. Okay.
Did you say
3334?
5334,
right.
Thank you, Chair Duncan. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. This is a small bill compared to the last bill, but a bill that we thought was necessary to bring up this session. Current statute provides, what House Bill 3334 does, and I want to preface all of my comments by saying this is not an anti-union bill, this is not an anti-employee bill, this is a bill that we think standardizes the process for all local governments. What House Bill 3334 does is it allows local special districts at the local level to make a determination through the resolution or ordinance process that it's the policy of the district to prohibit employees of the district from serving on the board of directors that employs them. Current statute permits this activity for a rural fire protection district, for our 800 special districts in the state of Oregon. 300 of them are rural fire protection districts, and they already have this authority. Hospital districts currently have this authority. School districts have this authority. Cities and counties under their home rule charter already have this authority. This bill would expand that authority to the remaining special districts in the state who do not have the authority, and let me explain to you why we're even bringing this bill forward. We've had some districts that have contacted us with potential problems with employees who run for the board of directors. It's a small district. They run for the board of directors. They're employed by the district. They run for the board of directors. And then because of the conflict of interest statutes that prohibit employees from voting on issues that would potentially or actually benefit them financially, they're not allowed to vote. And so they're excused from by nature of that statute. With small districts and small boards, many of them don't show up, so you may need all three people to conduct a business of the district, and in some cases that's not able to occur. We did put a provision in this bill that would require the district to adopt the resolution or the ordinance at least a year prior to the election, so you couldn't be a district that just all of a sudden did not appreciate who ran for your board and that it was an employee and you just reacted negatively by adopting an ordinance. This requires a thought-out process on the part of the district. We thought it was appropriate to put that to not put an outright prohibition, because some districts are small and they want the ability to have employees serve on their boards, but some districts would like to have the ability to prohibit employees that are employees of the district from serving on the board. So we think this standardizes the statute for all local governments and makes it more equitable.
Senator Trost, do you have any concern about the fact that that it could be retroactive, that that you could pass this and then some district could say we don't want an employee on the board, and then they kick some employee off the board because of that? He's already on, and he passed this, and then they decide they don't want somebody, and they kick him off, and he's been elected. Is that bother you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trost, I believe a provision of the bill is that a resolution must be in place prior, 1 year prior to the election of that board member. So under the provisions of the bill, I don't think the scenario that you're talking about could take place.
Prior to the date of the registration election, the first at least. Okay. So you think that anybody, how long a term do they serve? Just 2 years?
Actually, with me today is an actual district manager who would be much better versed in that, okay, in that scenario. So I'll let him.
They serve a longer term than that. If they have a 4-year term, for instance, you could be forcing somebody else for that.
Mr. Chair, that situation could arise, but that member would have to vote on the resolution in order to make it within his 4-year term while he's serving prior to its effective date. He would have to vote on that to make that resolution prior to him running for re-election. So as long as he was serving, he would be lawfully in the resolution.
Could be outvoted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be outvoted, and then wouldn't. Yeah, would that then?
What are those 4-year terms?
That's correct.
4-year privacy boards.
So you could actually have a board removing somebody who was elected for a term, and before the term is over, he would have a vote on that as that decision. But he might be outvoted if they want to get rid of him. Over.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, too, I also would add that this measure has no known opposition. The union seemed to be fine with it, and it passed 50 ayes, 4 no votes, and 6 excused in the House.
Rob, do you want to add anything here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Carnahan, and the Assistant Fire Chief of Clackamas County Fire District Number 1, which is the chair's district, and I'm representing him in that capacity, I guess, my employer as well as special districts. First of all, I would like to commend you for what you just did on the previous House bill that seemed to be so contentious. I had chaired the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee this year and had worked on that, worked hard on it in the House, and we have paid a considerable amount of money in staff time working in the interim since the 97 legislative session to fix those things, and it was a surprise to us when it came up in the House, and it was a surprise to us once again that it came to you, but I commend you for your efforts on that particular day.
Off the board. Because of that, he's already on, and he passed this, and they decide they don't want him, and they kick him off, and he's been elected. Does that bother you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, I believe a provision of the bill is that a resolution must be in place one year prior to the election of that board member. So under the provisions of the bill, I don't think the scenario that you're talking about could take place.
As far as the date of the registration election, the script is... Okay. So you think that anybody, how long a term do they serve? Just 2 years?
Actually, with me today is an actual district manager who would be much better versed in that, okay, in that scenario. So I'll let him.
They serve a longer term than that. If they have a 4-year term, for instance, you could be forcing somebody else, perhaps.
Mr. Chair, so that situation could arise, but that member would have to vote on the resolution in order to make it within his 4-year term while he's serving prior to his effective date. He would have to vote on that to make that resolution prior to him running for re-election. So as long as he was serving, he would be lawfully and legally seated on that.
Could be outvoted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be outvoted and then wouldn't. Yeah, would that then?
But are those 4-year terms?
Correct.
4-year privacy boards?
So you could actually have a board removing somebody who was elected for a term and before the term is over. He would have a vote on that as that decision, but he might be outvoted if they want to get rid of him.
Over.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, too, I also would add that this measure has no known opposition. The union seemed to be fine with it, and it passed 50 ayes, 4 no votes, and 6 excused in the House.
Rob, do you want to add anything here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Carnahan. I'm the Assistant Fire Chief of Clackamas County Fire District Number 1, which is the chair's district, and I'm representing him in that capacity, I guess, my employer as well as special districts. I first of all would like to commend you for what you just did on the previous House bill that seemed to be so contentious. I have chaired the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee this year and had worked on that, worked hard on it in the House, and we have paid a considerable amount of money in staff time working in the interim since the 97 legislative session to fix those things, and it was a surprise to us when it came up in the House, and it was a surprise to us once again that it came to you, but I commend you for your efforts on that particular day.
That's exactly what I have.
Well, the last time I was before you, Mr. Chair, was on a bill that followed the veteran loan extension, and I was in my full dress uniform and was mistaken for an admiral in the Navy, and was told about all sorts of so I'm in civilian clothes today, but nevertheless I am representing the fire district, and have submitted written testimony. I'd just kind of like to briefly go over that because I've been there, done that as far as this. I've been an elected official of a fire district. I was also a volunteer in that fire district, and I'm an employee of a fire district now, a different fire district, and had been a fire chief and now an assistant fire chief, and I've seen the problems that can come up when you have a person that is an ordinate and a subordinate at the same time. It recognizing that this is a local option measure, it just seems to me to make sense that the people in where it's appropriate, where there's considerable community involvement in their local governments, would have the option to limit their employees, especially with collective bargaining issues, wage, also the employees' benefits. And it's not a mandate from the state that you shall, but it certainly gives those local governments the option, and elected officials the option to do that. Now, I'd be more than glad to respond to any questions that you may have. I'm sure you supported the bill, and thank you for your time.
Rob, did you officially identify?
Yeah, you did.
If you officially identified yourself for the record, did I think you did?
Any questions for Rob?
Sure.
Are there some horror stories where people have
posed problems for districts because of the fact that they're employees? My guess is that some of those employees could be very conscientious, faithful, diligent, loyal, knowledgeable members of the board.
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, there are horror stories, and there are also success stories where people that are community-minded have come in and served in both a policy-making role and also a service provision role. And I would like to think that when I served in that role that there was positive things, but there were also a number of issues that came up where you were put in a position of being the boss of the CEO and an employee of the CEO.
Now, Rob, you were in that. You were an employee
in that position, and I chose
to resign. We passed a bill on the Senate putting the CEO on the board, a voting member.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trout, certainly that situation exists. The trouble is in the communities and small local governments, and particularly in special districts where there's one interest, there's the potential and a case where somebody that has a vendetta and hasn't been able to work out things in within the proper chain of command can go out, muster the votes to get elected, and then really grind that local government to a halt and just prevent that.
That can happen.
But
you say that has happened.
That has happened.
Okay. Other questions? Robert, Christina?
Christina, you pointed out a few minutes ago that the vote was 50-4, and I happen to have the vote count here. I noticed that it's Representatives Bowman, Morissette, Rosenbaum, and Taylor. Did you talk to any of them and find out what their concern was with the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I did speak with Representative Bowman about her concerns, and she raised concerns during the hearing, and not to characterize her concern, but I believe her concern stemmed from what she believes. I don't think she quite understood the current existing conflict of interest statute. Her comments to us during the House General Government hearing revolved around the fact that if she's an employee, she works for a commissioner.
The court.
And if she chose to run for the Multnomah County Commission, she would really not appreciate having the county having some sort of ordinance prohibiting her from doing that. I think our comments were to her regarding that situation were, the reason we're trying to get this legislation passed is to limit the number of conflicts of interest that occur, and I think her concerns revolved around the fact that I think that she continued to believe that she could still vote on contracts that affect herself and other employees, because it wasn't just her contract, it was all employees. So I think there was a little misunderstanding about the current statute on actual and potential conflicts of interest. Representative Taylor had indicated to our the president of Special Districts Association is Representative Taylor's in Representative Taylor's district, and she had indicated she was voting for the bill, so I'm not sure why she changed her mind. So
okay.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Mitch. I'm going to close the public hearing.
I'm going to hold the work session. Come back to it maybe. Representative Devlin is here for which? Let's see. You're here for the which?
30.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3025, as amended. Welcome, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It is very nice indeed to appear in front of a 5-member committee and not a 12-member committee like I just came from. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3025, I sponsored this bill because of my concern for people with disabilities who find the current law regarding notarization to be an impediment. Some people with disabilities find the requirement to sign certain documents in front of a notary is impossible or difficult. For those people that are blind or lack muscle control in their hands, the requirement of signing in front of a notary may be impossible. For those few people that are unfortunately put in the circumstance of having occasionally to put a pencil in their mouth to put an X on a piece of paper, it may be not only an impediment, it may be very demeaning and humiliating. This bill attempts to resolve that. It allows the use of a signature stamp by people with disabilities on documents requiring notarization. The full support of the Oregon Disabilities Commission has the full support of the Secretary of State's office, has 19 co-sponsors of the bill. It passed the House on 60-0 vote. And I ask for your support.
Do you think the bill's in trouble? Okay. Any questions for Representative Devlin?
We're still looking for opposition.
Yes. And by the way, Eugene Oregon did have to leave, and he's left his written testimony, so could we be sure to get that in the record?
Yeah. Too bad we didn't hear.
I'm sorry.
Chairman, and if you do refer the bill onto the floor, which undoubtedly is my hope, Representative Shields is a co-sponsor of the bill, as is Senator Fisher, and Senator Fisher had actually expressed a personal interest in carrying the bill. He has a daughter that's blind. If he doesn't carry it, he will probably speak on it.
Okay, fine. All right. I'm going to close. Yes.
And how do you know for sure that blind person is that person who will hold the staff?
Senator Lynn, Mr. Chapman, they would have to go through the same normal process that any other person would have to do in terms of presenting identification to prove that they are the person who is going to be signing a driver's license and other documentation, just as anyone else would.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3025. Maybe I'll just quickly open a work session on House Bill 3025.
I move House Bill 3025 before the Senate to dispatch.
Senator Crowe moves House Bill 3025 before the dispatch recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3025 will be sent to the floor. You pass recommendation. We'll check whether Senator Shields or Senator Fisher will be carrying.
Ask Senator Fisher if he'll do it, if he will.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. It's good to have you here today. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3334. That's when we just
were doing. Right. Mr. Chair, I guess I'd move 3334 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves 3334 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would make the case that at times it makes sense to have people who have a special knowledge on board. We last session passed legislation to allow a faculty member to serve on the Board of Higher Education. Sometimes it's important to get a point of view to represent a certain kind of interest to have such persons on board. This is very permissive, and I don't see any problem with it, but I do think that I'll bet there are a lot of very good people who work even for these boards who do it with great benefit to the board rather than to detriment. I'm sure there are some horror stories, but I'll support this.
Well, I'll be supporting the bill, too. I would go for a stronger bill. I guess I would. I almost think anyone who's involved in the situation where you're setting your salary and so forth and dealing with all the issues that goes with employment, it's hard to be your boss and
to be a vote member too. I recognize in the private sector with maybe that's part of the problem with corporate boards and so forth, where the CEO is a member of the board, I've often questioned that. Maybe it's because I've been the CEO in the public sector and haven't quite seen it. But anyway, I will be swearing. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Kirk? Yes.
My comments follow up on what I said earlier. I have a great deal of respect for Morris Stratton Rosenbaum as well. I'm just hoping that there isn't something hidden that we didn't notice. But maybe it's just the chaos of the House at any given moment that you've got a couple people, you know, voting no on something that they haven't had a chance to discuss. Some of them.
We never have any chaos.
Not in the Senate.
The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynn?
Aye.
Senator
Keel?
Aye.
Senator
Crowell?
Aye.
Senator Duncan? Aye. Senate Bill 3334 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I would be happy to read the bill. I'm about due to do one, I think. All right. Have a quick work session on 3334. Thank you very much, Rob and Ms. Amos. I'm going to now open a public hearing on House Bill 284 as amended. Very patient this afternoon, Mr. Schuster. How are you doing? Yes.
Uh-huh.
You should not get any stabs in the back while you're presenting.
You might feel a little lonesome out there.
Oh, no. I was an only child. I never feel lonely. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Housing and Human Services Department. This bill deals with the Housing Development Guarantee Account, and for those of you more familiar with the vernacular, that's the Orion Housing Trust Fund. And what this bill succeeds or proposes to do is to allow trust fund awards to be awarded either as a grant or a loan. Current statute mandates that the trust fund awards be dispersed as grants. But believe it or not, there are some circumstances where a grant is not in the best interest of a housing project. And two instances come to mind. One, if a for-profit sponsor is actually interested in providing affordable housing, you'll find that that trust fund grant turns out to be a taxable occurrence, and we lose 30% of that grant to taxes as a result of making a grant. However, if we make it as a loan, then the full value of the loan stays in the project. The second is that, and due to the quirks of federal tax credits, if you make a grant to a affordable housing project, that reduces the amount of tax credits that can be awarded to that project. So again, it's in the interest of the project to have a loan rather than having a grant. So we proposed this, and on the House side, two issues came up. While I think everyone generally trust the department at present, there was no assurance that we wouldn't somehow abuse that privilege and in the future only issue loans to people who were successful in our competition. So they asked, and we agree that it's appropriate. You'll see in the bill's language that it's provided as a loan or a grant at the awardee's discretion. Whatever form the awardee wants to receive it. If they want to receive a grant, great. But if they're in their best interest to receive it as a loan, that's fine too, and we'll do it however they feel benefits them the most. The second issue was what would be the interest rate on that loan. And so sort of the rule of thumb, the easiest and best standard to apply would be long-term treasury rates, which tend to be generally low. And so it was agreed upon that that would be an appropriate interest rate. And actually, if you make it a loan at an interest rate less than that, sometimes that's considered a grant, which could get us back in the same trouble we've got with the current grant system. So I think we worked all those conflicts out. The Oregon bankers supported the bill as amended after we worked on it, and certainly the entirety of the Housing Lobby Coalition, which you've come down and they've heard some related to the trust fund, supported these amendments as well.
Okay. Go ahead. No,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just was wondering, on line 15, at the awardee's election,
does it make sense always to allow the awardee to decide
whether or not it should be a grant or a loan?
For the reasons that are recited to, whether it avoids being a taxable occurrence or it affects their federal tax credit rate, yes, we wanted to make sure it was their decision. And as I mentioned, some of the housing advocates were fearful that the long-term strategy of the department might be to always issue loans so we got some money back, and we would never provide a grant, even though it was at our discretion. So they wanted to make sure that that decision was at the awardee's election.
And you think that doesn't...
We're comfortable with that. We recognize that the original intent was to give the money away in advance. It's just a disadvantage in some circumstances. So if it's to the advantage of the awardee to get it as a loan, that's fine with us.
Well, when you're making a choice, I suppose you make the choice with the idea they're going to get either a loan or a grant. But would you make different choices if you knew that you could determine that they got the loan rather than the grant, or if they got the grant rather than the loan? But would that have you make a difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Trowe, our process, the way we conduct it at present, is we do a lot of preliminary commitments to a project, saying that the money is available to you, and then we ask the awardee to go and finalize their finance package, identify who their tax credit syndicator is, who's going to be the long-term lender, who's going to be their construction lender. I think what we're providing here is the opportunity of making a commitment and then letting them decide through the course of finalizing their finance package which avenue they want to pursue.
Okay.
May I ask a question here first, and then this may help me. Okay, I had a letter from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. My understanding, and my assessment, I guess your assessment, were you familiar with their concerns? Or what they were concerned with that language in sub 1-2, where so the county investment shall be versus grant or loans at the awardee's election. Okay. So it seems this could leave the door open for people to decide if they want to receive a grant or a loan after they've been awarded funds. The commission believes that this language was clarified, so the organizations must choose to apply for a grant or loan at the time they file their original request. We could support this bill. The commission is acutely aware of the urgent need for additional affordable housing for seniors and people with disabilities. My understanding at this point, this letter dated March 29th, but I understand at this point that they are satisfied. Did you talk to them, too?
Mr. Chair, yes, we've resolved that. I think they're comfortable with our process satisfied.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to get that on the record that I had that comment. Any other questions? Yes.
He just doesn't pay attention to Methodist.
Go on. I know, on and on. Oh.
We've been talking about the theoretical, when in fact in the real conversations that go on, early on, is it not quite possible that you'll be talking to these people and saying, you know, you've applied for this grant or this loan. The way we look at it, it probably is much to your benefit to have it a loan in this situation or a grant in this situation. So all that stuff is pretty well talked about in the real world anyway. You're not prohibited from talking about it so that everybody have a pretty good understanding of whether it's going to be a grant or a loan early on anyhow. Is that not true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I think that's accurate. But again, advocates wanted the assurance that it would be the sponsor's election, not our dictating to them what they were going to receive.
Right. But you still have the power as to who gets the awards anyway. I mean, you know.
Have you been doing loans already?
Oh, yes, Your Chair.
No.
What? No, not loans.
Statute then has to be a grant.
So the loan is the new thing.
The loan is the new aspect, yeah.
But this gives them an opportunity to give some advice, maybe not direction, but some advice. And certainly, if I were one of the corporations that I've worked with a lot that's, you know, asking for some help to build some low-income housing somewhere, and these guys have some money, I'm going to be listening to their suggestion as to how to get the most out of that money. And if it helps me to not to waste 30% of it, for instance, on taxes to get it as a loan, I'm going to be listening to them.
Other questions?
You just read it.
Yeah.
And how are we going to address those issues instead of...
I guess they got resolved, as you said.
How did you resolve it? I didn't know.
the specific language of the letter, as I recall, they were concerned when that option would be available to them. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So we will go through
a tiny proposal here, talking about the deal is talking about at the end of the
it seems this would leave the door open for people to decide if they want to receive a grant or a loan after they've been awarded the fund. With that language of town investment revenue shall be dispersed as grants or loans at the awardee selection. That's what their concern was.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Lynn, we do want to make it their choice. We make an award, which is essentially a commitment to that awardee, that the money is available to them. In terms of the actual disbursement, that's different than the award, and the letter I read it talks about the actual disbursement.
Mm-hmm.
They will have made that decision after the award whether they want it dispersed as a loan or a grant. So it will still be their decision. And I think that's the understanding we came to the new discussion.
However you worked it out, you made them happy. So That's good. Okay. Any other questions? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2084, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2084.
Mr. Chair, assuming that the bill is in good shape and doesn't need any changes, I'm going to move that we send it before the due pass recommendation.
And that was 2084. Right. Okay. Senate Patrol moves House Bill 2084 as amended.
No, the
A, 2084A. To the House for Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shannon. Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator
Crowe. Aye.
All right. House Bill 2084A will be sent to floor with a due pass recommendation. Did Senator Shields want to carry that? I'm sure he does.
Okay.
Senator Shields will carry the bill. I'm closing the work session.
Go ahead. Before you close the meeting, I want to speak.
2084 amended. I'm closing the work session on that. Now, I'm very concerned. What did you have?
Well, I had to go on phone on some press calls. I would like to be recorded on some of these. Did they pass?
Yes.
All of them did. And I support them all. But I already voted on this one, and he didn't do that.
I can open a work session on House Bill 3334.
Shannon votes aye.
Closing the work session on House Bill 3334. Opening the work session on House Bill 3025A.
Shannon votes aye.
Shannon votes aye on House Bill 3025A. Closing the work session.
Thank you.
I think that's it.
Well, wait, did you do the one on 3334? That's the one I wanted to.
Didn't I do that one a second ago?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay. That's all. Okay, thanks. All right.
Are you done?
We are.